Good afternoon. I will call to order this remote meeting of the House Commerce Committee and ask Mr. Brown to take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Present.
Vice Chair Cotizza-Wattoon.
Present.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Present.
Representative Barr.
Here.
Representative Carlson. Representative Dabney. Representative Elkins. Representative Haley. Representative Cagle. Representative Lee.
Lee present.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly present.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard present.
Representative Lucero.
Present.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen present.
Representative Richardson.
Present.
Representative Tice. Representative Carlson.
Carlson present.
Representative Dabney. Representative Elkins. Representative Haley. Representative Cagle.
Present.
Thank you. And Representative Tice.
A quorum is present. Members, our first item of business today is the approval of our minutes from March 19th, 2021. Representative Cotizza-Wattoon, have you had a chance to review the minutes from that meeting? I think maybe she's on baby duty right now, so I will ask...
Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
I could move the minutes for you if you'd like.
Thank you very much. Any discussion to the O'Driscoll motion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
The motion prevails and the minutes for March 19, 2021 are approved. Members, we're going to have an important conversation today about a topic that couldn't be more important to the people of Minnesota, which is the economic cost of systemic racism in our state. As members are aware, Minnesota has some of the worst disparities in the country when it comes to outcomes on several indices for white people and people of color. And the legislature has been having an important conversation now for a little less than a year about the high cost of an impact of systemic racism throughout all aspects of our society, and led by in significant part by a member of our own committee, Chair Ruth Richardson, who, of course, in the last interim, chaired the select committee on this issue. I wanted the committee to have a chance to hear from an expert on this subject and to frame the issues related to economic disparities as we move into our critical decision-making period here at the legislature, not just in this committee, but overall, as we look at how we are going to have a budget for the state for the next 2 years. So with that introductory comment, and with many thanks to Representative Richardson for her collaboration in making today happen, it's my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Bruce Corey and give him the floor to discuss the economic cost of systemic racism and the Minnesota solution.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson, and thank you, Vice Chair Cotizza-Wattoon, Lead Driscoll, and Chair Ruth Richardson. Thank you for this opportunity to share thoughts on the economic cost of racism as seen through the lenses of the House Select Committee on Racial Justice, the report that was released, and the implications for the Commerce Committee. My name is Dr. Bruce Corey. I'm an economist over 30 years in Minnesota and over two decades of working with communities around the economic contributions of immigrants and minorities, and have become a community economist of sorts. And so it's with those lens, and I'm also a professor of economics at Concordia University, and had a wide range of experience in the area of business development, beginning with appointment to the chair the Working Group on Minority Business Development by Governor Ventura, and chairing the District Advisory Council of the U.S. Small Business Administration, and recently on a Community Advisory Board of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, but involved with a number of ethnic businesses and chambers of commerce over the years. So I'd like to bring some of that experience to you, and will share my screen now with a presentation on the Minnesota solution as it relates to this department, the Committee on Commerce and the Department of Commerce too. I want to lift up the House leadership and the Select Committee on Racial Justice and the members who have brought to Minnesota an important discussion in a form and content that is timely and needed, and at the same time being reflected in House leadership as we discuss this very important topic. I want to frame my conversation by going to the website of the Minnesota Department of Commerce and looking at its mission, a very as it engages with these many areas from energy, financial institutions, fraud, insurance enforcement, telecom, licensing, weights and measures. And this Department of Commerce, the mission is to protect the public interest, advocate for Minnesota consumers, ensure a strong, competitive, and fair marketplace, strengthen the state's economic future, and serve as a trusted public resource for consumers and business. That's a great vision, and it captures some of the role that an institution like that and this committee plays in creating a strong, competitive, and fair marketplace for all. As an economist, we study the free market in a theoretical way and understand the conditions that have to be present for some of the benefits, the very strong benefits of free markets to occur. But obviously, in the context of a racial environment, the free markets, the competition, and the fair marketplaces have become more of an aspiration, as we've seen some of the negative impacts of as documented in this report of the House Select Committee on Racial Justice. So it rightly points out that racism is a system and not an individual character flaw or a personal moral failing. It's a system of power that structures opportunities such as education, housing, jobs, and justice, and assigns value, worthy or unworthy, full of potential or full of menace, based on the so-called race, the social interpretation of how we look. And the conclusion of the House Select Committee of Racial Justice is that history and data leads the Select Committee to conclude the following, that systemic racism exists, systemic racism is harmful, systemic racism must be addressed. And I've been honored by having been invited by many committees in the House to present these ideas. And I, what I understand, there is practically no one who denies the conclusion of this Select Committee that systemic racism exists and it is harmful and needs to be addressed. And the patterns and forms of the discrimination, it really messes up the way markets work, because it prevents small minority businesses from succeeding at different phases, whether it's from startup finance, contracts, rules, regulations, they all come and interview into the functioning of these small entrepreneurs, with the result that the average size of this minority businesses is a very small fraction of Minnesota businesses as a whole. And in the area of housing, the great wealth builder in our lives, this patterns of discrimination comes in the way a mortgage is accessed and paid, location of where a person could live, and this historical experience with redlining. Recent studies talk about higher property taxes and appraisals that come up at a lower level, and all of these contributing to the lower equity value of a home or the access to a home by our communities. So this recent study by the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis documents and quantifies some of the discrimination in property appraisal, in property taxes, and the resulting result in loss in wealth. And so the graph shows, and the reason why I put this graph, it might be difficult to read, but it just shows Minnesota on this map of the nation and shows that we do have a situation like this that exists here. And higher property valuations result in minorities nationally paying around $390 extra in property taxes. And if you look at the total number of homeowners, minority homeowners in Minnesota, this would account to about $53 million a year. And in the Black community, they would be paying $11 million a year. And it's a significant fact because the African-American community in general have lower levels of asset and wealth-building capacity and paying. The study concludes nationally that the extra amount that could be attributed to these higher taxes eats away their complete wealth-building capacity. Studies have also shown that Black homes are devalued as much as $48,000 on average. And if we put this number in the Minnesota context, this would mean a loss in about $1.3 billion in wealth capacity of the Alana BIPOC communities. We also have the footprints of racism codified and memorialized in these redlining and covenants that have been established that identified where someone could live. And the economist out at Harvard, Raj Shetty, has documented by using big data that where you live matters a lot for your children's and your own chances for social mobility. And so we have an impact that is of a redlining that has eroded the wealth-building capacity of our communities. So these different patterns of a system of racism is reflected in these gaps that we are assuming, we are observing, whether it's an income with Blacks earning 71 cents on the dollar compared to whites, or the racial education gap, where there's a 21% gap in the six-year graduation rates between Blacks and whites, or in the racial housing gap, there's a 53% gap, homeownership gap between Blacks and whites, or a racial investment gap into the size of a small business. And so when I put all these together, I offer an estimate of the economic cost of racism to be $287 billion. And the flip side of it is Minnesota's wealth would have been $287 billion higher, and the loss in state revenue at least $2 billion. And so this $287 billion can be broken down into the loss in income. Something very significant, this $174 billion loss in lifetime earnings, is the loss of our existing workers who are not at the level of education that they need to be and are over their lifetime are losing a huge segment of their income. There's loss of business revenue because of the smaller size, the home ownership loss, as I mentioned earlier. Nationally, this study is also reflected in a Citibank study that documented these same disparities nationally and offered that closing the Black wage gap, for instance, could add about 0.2% to GDP or about $2.7 trillion in income. So everybody gains if we address this challenge and this history of systemic racism. If we close these gaps and address these issues, everyone can be better off. The House Select Committee on Racial Justice has a number of recommendations. I won't get into them, but they focus on things that don't cost money, that is better enforcement, say, of business contracting, and things that cost investment, that require investment, such as a $1 billion fund that could establish an economic development infrastructure all across Minnesota that could offer grants, equity, loans, technical assistance, capacity building, land trusts, funding, financing of economic development projects, affordable housing, and so on. And what the challenge and the opportunity that we have today is to looking at a critical eye, are we making the right investment and policy changes to create these competitive fair markets? So in this visual, you see different people climbing up the ladder of life and systemic racism denied people a ladder or offered them a very flimsy ladder to enable success. And what we could do is to get everybody on the same plane with everybody having an equal access to opportunity and success. And so the Alana Community Brain Trust, it's a group of community members that came together as a result of the COVID crisis and later the civil unrest to address the critical capacity and capital shortage and capacity challenges in our community because these recent events have pushed the community back. The economic progress made tremendously, and we need to address that. And so we focus on the concept of shared sustainable prosperity, shared by all and sustainable. And so what I want to offer you today is a framework that you could that could help as you look at policies and proposals coming your way, both in this committee and the Department of Commerce, as to the way markets can be kept more competitive and fair to all. And these four categories I offer are, one is looking at the adverse impact, the possible adverse impact on the Alana BIPOC communities. What kind of protections are there in place to make sure that these communities are not harmed? How could we leverage the resources and the abilities and the power that this committee and this department has, tremendous leverage to make things right and to close these gaps? And how do we measure success and show that we are closing the gap? I'll go through each one of them a little bit and talk about some dimensions. When you look at the impact, we've got to look at it with cultural intelligence. For instance, we have the four large groups, the African, Latino, Asian, and Native American groups. And so each one of them have their own history and experiences in the system that's different from the other. At the same time, when you look within these communities, there's a wide range of differences. For instance, I have a picture from the Cal Coalition of Asian American report recently that breaks down the Asian community into these large groups ranging from Asian Indians to newest refugees from Burma. And they have all different experiences. So you might have a community like the Asian Indian community that have very low poverty rates and high educational levels, but they have not come out from a history of racism. They have not come out from that background. There is a similar system of racism in India, and that's called the caste system. And the people at the very end of that caste system are the people called the Dalits. And this system has, I believe, more oppressive than slavery because it had a total domination of their lives. And so you would find not many of Dalits achieving economic and progress in India, nor would you find a lot of people from these communities in the U.S., because the U.S. tends to attract the brightest and the best into this highly skilled people that can compete more effectively. So looking at the different impact by communities and trying to see how could you make your programs more accessible. I was just talking to someone from the Kurian community, and she said, oh, they have a hard time in gas stations because of the language barriers to engage and even filling up gas. And so that's sounded are kinds of observations that people could benefit, a policymaker could benefit to make systems work better for all. The other, to look at the area of protection, and I feel quite strongly about this because we have a lot of protections for consumers, but we don't have a similar level of protection for small businesses. And I say feel strongly about it because I was quite closely involved with the situation of predatory lending with a female African immigrant business owner in the Little Africa area of St. Paul, where she got caught up into the snares of a predatory lender that charged her over 200% in interest and put a notice of foreclosure on her property. And a group of nonprofits were trying to pay off what was owed, but the predatory lender was very hard-nosed and wouldn't compromise a whole lot on the money. And till the very end, we didn't know how whether she would lose this prime property, which is in an opportunity zone just by Allianz Field. And I approached a wide range of policy people to help, but there could be no resources to help against this predatory lender. And a very low point was when she called me from the sheriff's office, where she had to go to meet and sign forms. And she called me and said, what can I do? What should I be doing? I don't know. The other party had a very a lawyer, an attorney, to handle their case. But this person didn't know what to do, what to sign. So this level of vulnerability cannot exist in a fair competitive market. And so the group Responsible Business Lending Coalition nationally has come up with this great borrower bills of rights, which I hope that the state of Minnesota would adopt. New York just passed it and it followed California. And so Minnesota could be the third state in the nation. And what they're asking for is something really basic, and that is the right to transparent pricing, the right to non-abusive products, the right to responsible underwriting, the right to fair treatment from brokers, the right to inclusive credit access, the right to fair collection practices. And these predatory lenders, they are targeting minority BIPOC business owners with this easy form of money. And once they get into their grasp, then that's the end. And so they take one money from one group and lend it out to another. And it's something that we really need to address. The third area that that we could focus is how could we leverage the resources and that we have in our capabilities. For instance, the state, there are 270 plus state chartered banks, and I believe 100 plus credit unions. And I think total assets may be over $40 billion. So how could we leverage these banks and credit unions to improve access to capital? And banks and credit unions are willing to do it. For instance, I just, because of the failures of the PPP program to reach micro business, especially minority businesses, but we recruited about 10 banks and 3 nonprofits to receive the latest round of applicants from our community. So I personally engaged with 55 entrepreneurs as I connected them to these resources to access the system. And these banking partners were ready to access to accept these individuals. So how could we create an alliance of these banks and something that we could offer to these banks to help in risk sharing is a loan guarantee program, which the bankers tell me have been very effective during the PPP program to outreach their lending activities to businesses. How can we leverage the regulatory power of the state to provide access and opportunity to finance, insurance, real estate sectors? Because a lot of our communities are involved with payday lenders, but how about realtors and how do realtors and insurance agents relate to our communities? And the appraisal industry, I read in recent publications, is now acknowledging the issue and the challenge. And they are instituting the Appraisal Institute, for instance, has launched a strategy to recruit more BIPOC agents and in their profession, and that's the way to do it. And there's a whole lot of activity in terms of multi-ethnic and multicultural outreach. But how do we work with these communities to make sure that our people are getting the right advice, they're shown the right properties, they are given the right instruments so that they can build wealth effectively? And then since this committee and the department is also has some connection with the new technologies of the future, such as energy and digital technology, how could we use those sectors, because they have proven to be very effective in closing these gaps of oppression, whether we call it race or caste, around the world, because they are opening up a play field in a new area. And finally, we need to look at metrics, how we are doing well. In each of the areas of the mission of the Commerce Department spells it out well. What kind of metrics can we look at and monitor to make sure that we are achieving progress in our economy, to build a robust economy? And finally, I want to end by saying that investment in our BIPOC communities to close the racial gap is not a zero-sum game, that investments are first going to address the past injustices, past denial of wealth, but the act of doing it is going to benefit all. So we have an economic model, and this is a very standard input-output implant economic model that could help us get an educated guess about what would happen if things change. So if we run this model about how, if we close the business gap in Minnesota, what would happen to the rest of Minnesota? And the model says the rest of Minnesota, we can expect that output would increase by $111 billion, and this could impact about 500,000 jobs and generate about $13 billion in federal, state, and local taxes. So give some idea that it's not a zero-sum game. There could be benefits that could accrue to the whole of Minnesota. So we are in a very important time, and I thank you for this opportunity to share, and I'll be happy to answer any question now or after as we work together to build shared sustainable prosperity for all. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Corey. That was a very illuminating presentation and very helpful suggestion of a path forward, and a timely one as well, given the conversations we've had in our committee over the last weeks and the decisions we'll be making in the coming days. So very much appreciate that. I will ask you to stick around for questions. I don't see anyone asking any questions right at the moment, but I expect a discussion as we move forward. We do, members, have a few other guests in the committee today who wish to speak to this issue, starting with the Commissioner of the Department of Commerce, Commissioner Grace Arnold. Commissioner Arnold.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and members. Let me just find my remarks here. So for the record, I'm Grace Arnold, and I'm the Temporary Commissioner of the Department of Commerce. It's a privilege to be on the agenda today. As Dr. Corey mentioned, the 2020 House Select Committee on Racism found that systemic racism exists, it's harmful, and it must be addressed. And you heard a lot about the opportunities today that Dr. Corey sees in our department. I'm really excited to be able to talk about some of the things we're doing and hopefully put a plea out for ideas of what we aren't doing that we should be. So, you know, BIPOC communities in Minnesota have long lacked access to the full benefits of the economic systems that operate under this committee's jurisdiction because of how these economic systems have been designed and developed. The Commerce Department, as generally a regulatory body, has a role in these economic systems. We also have not traditionally had strong connections to the communities most affected by the industries and professions we regulate and most adversely affected when there are inequities in those industries. The department recognizes this. We have a responsibility to engage in overdue conversations with community leaders and organizations in the Black, Latinx, Asian Pacific Island and African diaspora communities, as well as with the industries that we regulate. To understand what these communities are asking for and how we as a regulatory body can take concrete steps to structure the markets and professions we oversee more equitably. Commerce has begun this work by asking rather than assuming. We've begun to work directly with leaders of the BIPOC communities to define their greatest challenges and help design solutions within our regulatory scope. Additionally, we've spoken with representatives of some of the industries that we regulate about systemic racism, and they've been very eager to be part of an inclusive and collaborative approach to addressing these inequities. Commerce has a number of strategic priorities related to equity, and I'll highlight a few of these today. First, we have begun in the last few months a long-term outreach and research project led by the University of Minnesota and business leaders in Minnesota's Black community. The focus of this work is the causes of and solutions to fix inequities in the banking and lending that impact Black Minnesotans and Black-owned businesses. Dr. Corey gave some really great, well, they're not great statistics, but gave some statistics to illustrate the problems in those areas. Over the course of this effort, Commerce will look for opportunities to convene stakeholders to design equitable, innovative, and inclusive projects in this space. Our hope is that this project will help to define regulatory fixes in the future. Second, insurance regulators from across the nation are working together through the National Association of Insurance Commissioners to examine discriminatory outcomes within the insurance industry. This work began before my appointment to the role, and I believe members have a copy of a letter sent by former Commissioner Kelly to the NAIC last summer in support of this national effort, and we've continued to participate. I want to acknowledge that several sectors of the insurance industry have made public pronouncements of support of these efforts, and I appreciate that they have not only been willing, but also very eager to be part of an inclusive and collaborative approach to addressing systemic racism and inequities. We're working with representatives of BIPOC communities to determine their comfort level with questions regarding race and ethnicity and data gathering in the insurance space. And I expect that this will be a space where you will see future legislative proposals from the department. The third thing I'll speak to today is we heard about inequities in the housing industry and opportunities within the real estate appraiser in particular, the inequities within the appraisal industry and then the potential for some fixes there. So the department has a really important role to play in both the real estate side and the appraiser side. Commerce staff are working with the Minnesota Realtors Association and key stakeholders in the appraisal industry on a continuing basis on continuing education for licensees in these fields on a consistent basis. The proposal that was passed by this committee last week to create a requirement for Minnesota appraisers to take a course in valuation bias during their next renewal cycle is a first step in this work. We also have the opportunity to take direct action to support collaborative and innovative approaches toward breaking down the mechanisms of systemic racism that have prevented BIPOC Minnesotans from building wealth through home ownership. The department's in the process of developing an RFP for a new grant cycle from the Real Estate Education Recovery Fund, and we hope to have that available in the next quarter. So members should expect more information on that opportunity soon. Finally, one specific legislative priority that the department that's not within the jurisdiction of this committee, but I'd ask for your support of. We've partnered with the tribal governments on the creation of a tribal advisory council on energy that will be a tribally appointed and run entity designed as a permanent venue for Minnesota's tribal nations to engage with the state on improved energy practices that will affect tribal nations and members. We've included a copy of the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council's resolution in support of this proposal for members. So in closing, I'll say that as a regulator, Commerce oversees many of the financial systems that Minnesotans interact with every day. And that means two things. First, it means that our actions are one step removed from the outcome. We cannot make a program change and see immediate benefits. But the second thing that means is that we have an enormous opportunity because we have influence over the entirety of the systems that have let so many people down for so long. We'll continue to look for every opportunity to listen and collaborate with BIPOC communities and our regulated industries towards creating a Minnesota that we can all call the best place to live. So for those who are watching or legislators, I'd invite you to please reach out with ideas. We want to make sure that we're hearing feedback. We want to make sure we're on the right track and we're really delivering for the community. So thank you for the opportunity to comment today, Chair Stevenson. I'm happy to stand for questions or pass it along to the next presenter.
Thank you, Commissioner Arnold. We do have two additional presenters, testifiers, so we'll move through those, but members should feel free to raise their hand if they have questions either for Dr. Corey or Commissioner Arnold. And thank you, Commissioner Arnold, for the great work that's happening at the department. We clearly have a lot of areas that we can collaborate on and continue to improve to serve all Minnesotans and make sure they're all receiving equitable outcomes. Our next presenter is no stranger to this committee. It's our good friend, Ron Elwood from Legal Services. Mr. Elwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Thank you so much for inviting me to say a few words today. I'm really honored to be included in this presentation today. What we're talking about here in an hour could easily be covered in a semester's long college course. But in the few minutes that I do have, please allow me to make just a couple of points about how systemic racism has impacted the ability of BIPOC consumers, including Legal Aid's clients, to obtain affordable credit and build assets. I want to talk about both access to credit and terms of credit. Home ownership is universally recognized as the best way to build equity and wealth. But as Dr. Corey alluded to, the tragic legacy of government-sponsored redlining is now well known. But its effects are still being felt today, as we know that Minnesota has perhaps the worst home ownership disparities in all of America. And further, access to other forms of credit fall disproportionately along racial lines. While explicit racism has certainly manifested itself, the disparate impacts of implicit bias are less visible, but perhaps more pervasive. As a recent Washington Post article finds, and I quote, discrimination is often hidden in policies or in the case of credit scoring, products that purport to be race neutral, unquote. And Forbes magazine from a February 21st 2021 article just a couple of weeks ago points out, quote, a long history of discrimination affects the data that are in use in credit scoring models today. 26 million Americans are credit invisible. Of those, people of color have higher credit invisibility ratings. More than one in five Black consumers have FICO scores below 620. And meanwhile, one out of 19 white people are in the sub 620 category. And lastly, with respect to terms of credit, fringe lending has become pervasive in low wealth neighborhoods. In a recent article in The Guardian, I quote, people and communities of color have been disproportionately targeted for high cost predatory loans, intrinsically risky financial products that predictably lead to higher delinquency and default rates than for non-predatory loans. And as a consequence, people of color are more likely than their white counterparts to have damaged credit. We need look no further for the blatant evidence of this than the subprime foreclosure crisis of the mid-2000s. That legacy and the equally shameful legacy of previous racial redlining continues to reverberate today, and nowhere more starkly than in North Minneapolis. And thus, a vicious cycle is perpetuated by racism and discrimination. Poor credit leads to high cost credit, which leads to worse credit, which leads to the perpetuation of individual and generational poverty. But I suggest today that the past need not be prologue. Things must change, and they can change. And where there is a will, there is a way. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Appreciate the opportunity to be with you today.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. It is always a pleasure to hear your testimony in this committee. And our last presenter testifier today is another frequent flyer in the Commerce Committee and friend of the Commerce Committee, Anna Odegaard of the Asset Building Coalition. Ms. Odegaard.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to present today. I really appreciate being invited.
My name is Anna Odegaard, and I'm the director of the Minnesota Asset Building Coalition. As many of you know, we are a statewide coalition of nonprofit organizations that are focused on supporting access to asset building opportunities for low-income Minnesotans, eliminating barriers to economic mobility, and advancing racial equity. Our work addresses the very cycle that Ron Elwood just outlined, where reduced access to credit and less favorable terms of credit for BIPOC communities in particular over generations has been a barrier to building wealth, which in turn makes BIPOC individuals and families more vulnerable to financial crisis. This directly impacts lots of the clients and communities served by the MABC member organizations. I'd like to share two areas of the work that MABC has focused on that really illustrate that impact of the systemic racism on the clients and communities that we serve and care about. As Ron pointed out, homeownership builds equity and consequently wealth. And as Dr. Corey discussed, there are significant racial disparities in homeownership. In Minnesota, the BIPOC ownership homeownership rate is half that, the homeownership rate of whites, and Black Minnesotans in particular who owning their homes at only one-third the rate of white Minnesotans. Mortgage payments are reported to credit bureaus and are one of the best opportunities to build your credit score, while rent payments are typically not reported. Therefore, the racial disparity in home ownership contributes to a racial disparity in credit scores. Credit scores impact access to economic opportunity in a lot of ways. For instance, having a car is often essential for getting and keeping a job. And in order to drive, you need auto insurance. I was very glad to hear the commissioner bring up the issue of disparities in auto insurance pricing. Your credit score can have a big impact on the cost of your auto insurance. Drivers with clean driving records but a low credit score often pay more for auto insurance than drivers with excellent credit but a recent DUI or at-fault accident. Because of racial disparities in credit scores, these high rates disproportionately impact BIPOC communities. Higher rates of reliance on public transportation is one way systemic racism puts BIPOC communities at a serious disadvantage in the job market. Systemic racism impacts transportation options in other ways as well. Some of you are familiar with the problem MABC has been focused on for a few years, which is that in Minnesota, your driver's license is suspended if you fail to pay a traffic ticket within 30 days. Not only are members of BIPOC communities more likely to be stopped and ticketed, but due to wealth disparities we've already discussed, many find paying off those tickets more difficult. The highest rate of license suspensions for unpaid tickets are concentrated in BIPOC communities across Minnesota. Like unaffordable auto insurance, a suspended driver's license prevents full participation in the job market. Communities that lack access to safe and affordable credit may turn to alternative sources like payday lending to pay off these court fines and get their driver's license valid again. But as you know, this kind of financial product can lead to additional asset stripping in those very communities. MABC member organizations are working with community partners, with folks inside the insurance industry and with regulators and with several wonderful legislative champions to end the suspension of driver's licenses for unpaid traffic tickets and to find ways to make automobile insurance more affordable for safe drivers who pay high rates because of non-driving factors like credit score. I really appreciate the opportunity to share just a few of these direct economic impacts of systemic racism that impact MABC members in our work. We deeply appreciate our legislative allies who are working to address these and many other barriers faced by our BIPOC communities. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Odegaard. We'll now have some time for member discussion and questions for our various testifiers and presenters today. I think if I could lead off in this question, I'll start with Dr. Corey, but if any of our other testifiers have an answer, I'd be interested in hearing from them as well. We've had some good discussion both last week and today about how disparate outcomes in appraisals impact BIPOC communities. I wondered if, Dr. Corey, if you are aware of policies that have been implemented in other states to get at this issue. I did hear Commissioner Arnold talk about some continuing education opportunities. And of course, we had that conversation in committee last week, but I wondered if you are aware or had any ideas of policy approaches either tried in other states or things that would be novel here in Minnesota that we could do specifically in the area of appraisals.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. I the study that I referred to from the Federal Reserve Bank offers a solution in terms of how properties are valued. It's not my particular area of expertise, but there is a solution there in terms of a methodology that they are recommending, and I can share with you that study.
Thank you, Dr. Corey. That would be very helpful to see that. It's certainly an area of interest to the committee. Are there other members with questions or comments that they'd like to make on the subject? Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for Ms. Odegaard, something that she and I have discussed in the past, but kind of trying to tie together through few threads. But Professor Corey was talking about credit scores, and you and I have talked about how credit scores can in turn affect auto insurance rates. Can you talk about that a little bit, what you found?
Ms. Odegaard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Elkins, thanks for that question. Yes, thank you. We've had some good conversations about that. And I have been in conversation about that, as I mentioned a little bit, with folks in the industry, who I think many of you also are familiar with. The president of the Insurance Federation, Aaron Cocking, has really also been interested in addressing this issue, as well as regulators and then national advocates. Some of you know the Consumer Federation of America has really focused on this issue, too, of disparities in auto insurance pricing. And one of the most heavily weighted factors that contributes to these disparities is your credit score. And so I'm happy to share. I have a number of handouts, and there are some articles that have demonstrated the disparities that are created because the credit score, which is a non-driving factor, but which figures into actuarial models or the actuarial formulas for determining auto insurance rates, does tend to disproportionately impact low-income communities and communities of color. And in particular, one that I mentioned a little earlier is that a person with a clean driving record but a low credit score is often going to pay more for basic liability insurance than a person with excellent credit but a conviction for a DUI. And I have some data around that for Minnesota specifically if people are interested in seeing that. It doesn't necessarily point to a solution, but I think it certainly points to a problem. And the conversations we've been having really have been about what are the best strategies for ensuring that good drivers who are low income or who are whose insurance rates are impacted by some of these non-driving factors, how are some of the best ways to make sure that that insurance is affordable for them? Because we recognize that for all the drivers on the road, there's a benefit for everyone to be insured. And we feel like there's a lot of common ground among stakeholders wanting to make sure that insurance is affordable.
Thank you, Ms. Odegaard. And if you would be so kind as to share that information with the committee administrator, who can then circulate it to the whole committee, I think that would be great information for the committee to consider. Representative Elkins?
That was fine. Thank you.
And I would also just add to the point that you and Representative Elkins and Ms. Odegaard were discussing that, I work as a prosecutor, as some members know, when the legislature is not in session. So I see how this issue that is being discussed becomes a criminal justice issue as people who have, less access to affordable insurance end up getting cited for driving without insurance and citing for driving after revocation or during a suspension, and it becomes a real criminal justice issue as well, and a burden for our courts, frankly. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Richardson and the presenters today. I appreciate that you're bringing this forward. I'd like to put out that I've heard Dr. Corey a couple times and just really been blessed by that and learned a lot. There's this video that was done by NPR, and I'm kind of speaking as legacy chair because I'm kind of proud it was done with legacy money. But it's Jim Crow of the North, and I really challenge everybody to watch it because I think there's some bias in Minnesota thinking that, that maybe we're better than the rest of the country and some of this didn't happen here and some of this systemic racism. But clearly with real estate practices and titles and ownership and deeds, they've been really approved that this we're not the golden land that we all like to think that we are sometimes, but and we can do better. So, and anyway, thank you, Mr. Chair, and having this discussion today.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. I certainly agree. We can do better. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Corey, thank you for coming and presenting. It's good to see you again. As I was listening to your presentation, you talked about entrepreneurship in the Alana community and differential wage rates and abilities to build wealth and access to capital. It got me wondering about the gig economy. And do we see differential experiences across our entire state population, but is there also a different experience in that space for the Alana communities?
Dr. Corey.
Chair Stevenson and Representative Dabney, that's a great question. I think there are some great opportunities in the renewable energy and the gig economy to make some rapid progress. Because the digital economy is opening the doors where at least now old assets such as family background or wealth, things like that are not so important as your ability to come up with a new innovation like a Twitter or a Facebook and get wealthy, fabulously wealthy. But at the entry level too, we are finding that those kinds of jobs, the digital tech pipeline are people with higher wages. They're getting higher wages. And that's why I commend the state and others for creating these digital pipelines through the workforce programs so that more of our students and more of our youth and more of our adults can get into that gig economy and benefit from it. So that presents a good opportunity for the future.
Representative Debbie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Corey. It's something to chew on how we support, my bias is towards young people, I'm afraid, how we get to move them from consumers of these things to producers and all of the apps and the like that are on them. I'm not convinced I want a new Twitter or a Facebook, but I appreciate the sentiment just the same. Thank you, Doctor. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Corey, I think one of the biggest things that I walked away from with the Select Committee on Racial Justice was just how much past public policy has influenced today and how when it comes to, let's say, mortgages, applying for a mortgage, it's you don't even need to see a lender face to face for them to get at the data of your race. And so I was just kind of curious if you could speak to that a bit. That was one of the biggest aha moments for me serving on that select committee.
Dr. Corey.
Chair Stevenson, Representative Cagle, if I understand your question is maybe around fintech and the applying for a loan online versus a face-to-face, which has the added challenges of discrimination, overt discrimination. And there have been some studies to show that they are those kinds of transactions are better in terms of addressing some of the racial gaps because they are going a lot on metrics. There are some dangers in those systems too, but the study I recently read about that was comparing these two systems found them to be a little better.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think just one of the things that was brought up during the Select Committee on Racial Justice was that because of past public policy that we have kept people in certain silos. And so you don't necessarily need to see somebody to realize, you know, that there's discrimination happening because of the silo that they fit into, because of our public policies that have been from the past few hundred years. And so that was just when I heard that and kind of put those things together, it really kind of gave me a gut punch. And so I'm really kind of curious about how we move forward and make sure that people aren't defined by past policies.
Thank you, Representative Cagle. Well, I think we had a great discussion today, and I really am thankful to all of our presenters, Dr. Corey, and to our own Chair Richardson for making this discussion happen today. And I hope that all members can use this, apologies for that, as we go through the important decisions that we will be making in the weeks between now and May 17th. So thank you, Dr. Corey, thank you, presenters, and thank you, Chair Richardson. The next item on our agenda is a bill, House File 2146, from our very own Vice Chair Katiza Watoon. Vice Chair Katiza Watoon, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would like to move House File 2146 to be before the committee.
Vice Chair Katiza Watoon moves House File 2146 before the committee. Vice Chair Katiza Watoon, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, members, House File 2146 is an appropriations bill for the Minnesota Council on Economic Education. One of my constituents, who is a professor at Gustavus, first brought this proposal to my attention. And as you'll hear today, MCEE does important work in assisting educators to better serve their students on their journey of personal finance and economics. Back in 2011, the legislature adopted state academic standards for economics and personal finance. These standards include standards and benchmarks at each grade level from kindergarten through grade 12. In our state, standards in personal finance fall within the economic standards. However, most Minnesota teachers are not adequately prepared to effectively instruct their students in these topics. Economics and personal finance are typically taught at the high school level by secondary social studies teachers. While Minnesota produces an abundance of teachers prepared in history, political science, geography, and the other social sciences, only 2% of secondary social studies teachers focus on economics or finance in their undergraduate preparation. Yet high school social studies teachers are often called upon to teach economics and personal finance at any time. Now, our elementary teachers, who must help their students meet economics and personal finance standards, typically have very little training in these areas, and many of them have never even taken one college course in economics. So, House File 2146 would appropriate $150,000 a year for the next 2 years from a Consumer Financial Literacy Education Fund within the Commerce Department to the Commissioner of Education in order to provide a support grant to the Minnesota Council of Economic Education in order to continue delivering a teacher professional development program that aligns with state standards and to increase the number of teachers who are reached annually. This program includes the provision of teacher workshops and courses. They range from first introductions to the topic to refresher and specialty workshops to full courses for graduate credit that all teachers with non-economic undergraduate and master's degrees need to become eligible to teach economics through the University of Minnesota's College in the Schools program. These workshops are offered in person in the Twin Cities and around the state through affiliated centers for economic education at 5 higher education institutions and online statewide. Mama, honey, I'm in a meeting. Can you wait? Thank you. The program also includes the training of a master teacher corps to serve as instructors and mentors to their fellow K-12 teachers throughout the state. These accomplished teachers train other teachers, both in subject matter content and in effective classroom implementation and management. MCEE is uniquely qualified to provide this professional development. There's no other organization routinely providing this type of professional development for Minnesota teachers. So in the testimony that follows, you will hear from Executive Director Julie Bunn about the challenges they currently face in order to meet this demand, and from an MCEE trained teacher about the important role this organization has played in preparing her to teach to the state standards. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to introduce Julie Bunn, Executive Director of MCEE.
All right, Ms. Bunn.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Stephenson and members. As she said, my name is Julie Bunn. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council on Economic Education. This council was formed in 1961 by a coalition of business leaders, labor leaders, and academics. From its inception, its goal was to increase the financial and economic literacy of all Minnesotans. This council is recognized and has been throughout its history as a national leader amongst all state councils. It's one of the most active, engaged councils in the country. Since its founding, it's trained over 35,000 Minnesota teachers and reached over 3 million Minnesota students. MC delivers on this mission, primarily by teaching teachers, training them to deliver on those economic and financial standards, and additional information on global food markets, the environment, climate change, and other topics. We also engage directly with students through competitions and capstone experiences and an intensive summer personal finance institute. Finally, we also reach communities by helping train the staff of community-based nonprofits to deliver customized financial literacy education to their clients. The target of our teacher professional development is the over 1,600 newly licensed teachers every year and the over 25,000 in-service teachers who are among the categories of teachers that can be at any time asked to or required to teach to these economics, personal finance standards in the state. Demand for our services increased during the pandemic. During the last fiscal year, we reached over 1,200 Minnesota teachers with professional development. This is over twice the number reached in each of the previous 2 years before the pandemic. This last year, we taught over 61 workshops and delivered over 360 hours of unique content to teachers. As Representative mentioned, we reach them through a variety of their stages of their career and also through a variety of mechanisms and platforms. We also are unique among all state councils in the country in offering workshops in culturally responsive and inclusive methods of teaching personal finance. Well over one third of NC programming centers on financial literacy and capability. The Minnesota State Personal Finance Standards and Benchmarks contain topics on budgeting and savings, investing, credit and consumer skills, including how to avoid fraud and to protect themselves as consumers. The budget for MSC to provide these services to teachers and students and to the public is well over $900,000 a year based on very detailed subprogram budgets. Over the course of our history and currently, a couple hundred thousand dollars a year come from private sector corporations and family foundations, most related to the financial sector and financial institutions, to deliver this education. But these resources are not enough to train the number of teachers and reach the number of students necessary to support the standards in economics and personal finance in the state. Across the United States, other state councils receive financial support from their state treasurers, from banking commissioners, from security commissioners, et cetera, and are thus able to have robust programming in these areas. The legislation before you, as Representative mentioned, appropriates funds from a consumer financial education account in Commerce for this purpose to MCE. MCE worked with Commerce to identify this funding source and to write this bill. At a time when the need for financial literacy education is greater than ever due to the crisis we've been experiencing, and a time when bipartisanly the legislature is moving forward multiple pieces of legislation to strengthen the personal finance requirement and more access for Minnesota high school students, and when the House Select Committee on Racial Justice underscored the need for more financial literacy education in this area, this funding will help underwrite the council's efforts to increase its personal finance teacher training efforts, student programming, and outreach to underserved populations. In closing, in addition to the teacher you are about to hear from, in your packet for this hearing and listed on the schedule document online is quotes from student evaluations of our programming and testimony from many more MC teachers trained by us. And also in an email sent to you previously are links to videos with more student and teacher testimony. This information also contains my contact information. Please feel free to reach out and ask additional questions. Thank you. We now have one more testifier.
Thank you, Dr. Bunn. And I think that this was a great example of just very skillful advocacy either by Dr. Bunn or Vice Chair Tisa Matu. And the next testifier is a teacher at one of the very finest high schools in the state, located in one of the very fine, or right across the street, I guess, from one of the very finest cities in the state that, you know, just by coincidence, I have the pleasure of representing, Ms. Jamie Shaw from Champlain Park High School. Ms. Shaw.
Good afternoon, Chair Stevenson and committee members. My name is Jamie Shaw. I am a social studies teacher at Champlain Park, one of five high schools in the Anoka-Hennepin District. I teach primarily economics and personal finance, as well as U.S. government and politics, both of which are required courses for seniors. I'm a graduate of St. Cloud State University, where I was first introduced to the Minnesota Council on Economic Education as an undergraduate. I've now been teaching for 22 years and have been involved with the Minnesota Council for every single one of those years. Through MCEE, I have attended countless professional development opportunities. I've taught thousands of high school students, everything from scarcity to banking and monetary policy. And it was because of the professional development opportunities through MCEE that I was able to expand my knowledge and network of other educators that gave me the tools to offer comprehensive and engaging lessons for my students. Nowadays, I have outgrown my role as a participant and I'm giving back, teaching and mentoring other teachers as a master teacher for the Minnesota Council. I have had 6 student teachers since 2010, all having taught economics and personal finance with me, 3 of which are currently teaching economics in other neighboring districts. Most new teachers that I've worked with are nervous about economics and personal finance. They are underprepared, it's scary, it's unknown, but as soon as I expose them to the wealth of information, the workshops, and the network of passionate teachers through MCEE, they never see economics and personal finance the same again. It's like fun and engaging and they love it. The projects I'm currently working on, I believe, are the most pressing for teachers and students today. First, for students, a college dollars and cents summer institute. A fellow master teacher and I recreated an online hybrid personal finance course for high school students that allows for live student-teacher interaction as well as a virtual component for flexibility. Last summer, we were able to triple our attendance because of this format and reach many students outside of the metro area that aren't able to attend the week-long class that's formerly in person. And then second, a culturally responsive personal finance workshop for educators. And this workshop is for teachers to learn ways to approach personal finance topics with an inclusive and equitable lens to a diverse group of students and make meaningful connections between what students learn in school and their cultures, languages, and life experiences. These connections then help students not only learn those important personal finance topics, but then develop higher level academic and problem solving skills and see the connection between what they learn at school and their lives. In teaching this workshop several times, it's evident that personal finance topics are extremely important to teachers. There's this push to teach a well-rounded personal finance curriculum in school, but many teachers feel unprepared or they have not found quality, culturally relevant materials. Workshop participants have overwhelmingly praised and have found value in the personal finance content, the usable lessons, and the ongoing teacher support. So, to summarize, economics and financial literacy are critical skills for our students. It is imperative that students and teachers are front and center when designing personal finance curriculum, training opportunities, and engaging lessons, and that is exactly the vision of the Minnesota Council. Thank you for your time, everyone.
Thank you. That it concludes the amount, the author's testimony, and we had no members of the public wishing to testify. Discussion to the bill. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate this topic. I believe that financial literacy is something, I tried to put my hand down there, lower hand. I believe that financial literacy is incredibly important for everybody's background, regardless of a person's background, where they come from, how they live, their lifestyle, because empowering people with information to make wise and prudent financial decisions is better off for not only them, but for their families and everybody. But I've heard both testifiers reference something called culturally responsive. So I'm curious if you could help me understand, if I were your student, how would you be culturally responsive to me versus my wife, who's Asian?
Dr. Bunn or Ms. Shaw, maybe Dr. Bunn's unmuted, so we can start with her.
I'll start by, I'm going to hand it off to Teacher Shaw to reflect on this. It's really about understanding as best you can first of all, what your own biases are before you walk into the classroom as a teacher. So where are you coming from? What, to what extent do you know about the lives and backgrounds of the student population in your classroom? What about your own history may lend biases to your lens through which you see them and through which you see the material? Secondly, by understanding your students, you are attempting to possibly incorporate things you know about their lives and culture into the current lesson and materials. But most importantly, it's about teaching methods. It's about listening to the students, drawing them out, and allowing them to bring their stories, their cultural background, and their family stories and histories into the material at hand, whatever curriculum you might be using. But I'm going to let Jamie Shaw expand on that now. Thank you.
Ms. Shaw.
Yeah, I mean, I think Julie did a great job of explaining that. I mean, it's really not about targeting a certain lesson or targeting a certain person, but rather the lens in which we teach and recognizing that people are in a lot of different places. We come from different communities. We value things. I mean, money is a very personal topic, and there's not one way to teach about what students should or should not do. A lot of problems that people face on a daily basis are multifaceted, and cultural experiences come into play when making decisions. And so it really, for teachers, it's about recognizing, you know, your biases or just the things that, you know, what makes your students unique and what, how can we highlight what they already know and using their experiences in their families or their personal lives or whatever to teach them new concepts. So yes, there are things that they need to know and there's vocabulary and there's processes that people should be familiar with, but it's also connecting with our students in ways which they can relate and bring those back to their communities and actually learn something meaningful.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And part of the answer I heard there was the decisions that people should make. And I guess maybe I'm misunderstanding, because when I think of financial literacy, when I think of the decisions that people should make, that's more kind of like in a financial planning. But again, this is a very broad topic. Financial literacy, each of us probably have different definitions. I guess when I think of financial literacy, I'm thinking of, you know, the definitions of various truths, timeless truths that aren't dependent on any culture or ethnicity or anything like that. Things like simple interest, compound interest, the time value of money, you know, things like that. But understanding the time value of money, understanding compound interest, if I have a clear understanding of how those things operate, that is separate than what decisions I should or should not make. But understanding what those things are, I guess I'm still not clear how you would teach me those truths versus teaching my wife. Right. How do you, I mean, what would the difference be?
Well, Dr. Bunn, I think, wants to comment to that. Dr. Bunn.
I agree there are certain concepts, and you referenced some concepts about time value of money or concepts of budgeting, how the banking system works, et cetera, that would be were just things one has to learn and know. Where the differences come in from the different cultural backgrounds is if you propose to your students that you go get an after-school job and you start making a certain amount of money, and you throw out the question, you know, what's the best way to use that money? How much of you should shave? How much of you should spend on consumables? What type of consumables? Well, depending on what culture you come from, you have a very different way of viewing that money you're earning. Some cultures and some families, it's your money. You're a high school kid, you go get an extra job, you can spend that on entertainment, maybe save for a car, etc. In other cultures, that's not just your money, it's family money, okay? It's part of helping to support your family. It's not viewed as just how do I maximize my own life plan. It's more of a communal decision, and it's a larger input into the family. So there are very different ways interests is viewed different in different cultures and different religions. Whether to use banking is viewed in different cultures. And access in different religions. So these are all things you have to have some awareness of, but mainly it's about different people view the same situation, the same facts, in some instances can be viewed differently from a different cultural perspective as to what the right decisions are, what the decision options are.
And Dr.
Bunn, thank you, Mr. Chair.
You did hint at this, but I did want, since Representative Lucero made the point of compound interest and the time value of money, I think it's really worth noting that across the globe, that cultures have very different views about the role that interest should play in lending and how interest should accrue. And so that's actually a very good example that you brought forward there, Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the time value of money is the value is not subjective. The formula to calculate the time value of money is objective. It's based on interest rate, inflation, deflation, things like that. It's not culturally sensitive.
Your right? mathematical
the answer is the way that dependent on objective variables. Thank you.
Representative Lucero, the mathematical equation may be objective. The way that you view it and how it impacts your life is subjective. Representative Elkins.
Yeah, thank you. I just want to say that I think, you know, pairing this bill with the preceding presentations really tie together nicely. And in terms of the, you know, I'm one of three economists in the House right now, and but I grew up in a family that was, you know, where there was a lot of financial literacy. My dad was a business executive, and so I grew up with that kind of stuff. But you know, I don't know if Ms. Odegaard is still here, but she and I have also had conversations just about basics about, you know, importance of being banked. You know, just understanding what a bank account is and how important it is to building a credit report, a credit rating. And these things just don't come naturally to everyone in every culture. And I think it's extremely important to, you know, teach these kinds of things in high school so that by the time a kid graduates from high school, they have at least the basic financial literacy and understand the importance of being banked and understanding what interest is and regard, you know, and as the chair was saying, it you know, if you're Muslim, you don't believe in interest, and there are ways of potentially addressing that, but you have to understand it in your cultural complex in context. And you know, one comment I would make to Representative Lucero is I think that the single most important book that I may have read in my entire economic life is a book called Thinking Fast and Slow, which was written by a behavioral economist who won the Nobel Prize in economics for he and his partner Amos Tversky, pointing out all of the ways in which human beings, the way we think, does not comport with the way people behave in economic textbooks. Literally, I think that's the most important book I have ever read.
Three economists, that's catching up to lawyers in the House, in the legislature, and making me a little bit uncomfortable. Representative Dabney.
You're muted, Representative.
I have a suspicion you were making a lawyer joke, so I'm really sad.
No, I was making a social studies teacher joke. But I was about to take a shot at with Dr. Bunn on the Zoom. We might have reached our max in economists. I'm not sure. But thank you. Dr. Bunn and Ms. Shaw did a very good job of responding to Representative Lucero and talking about the cultural concepts. You know, the question of whose money is it and what is my responsibility with that money? But back from when I was teaching personal finance, I just wanted to give one very simple, concrete example of trying to be more culturally responsive with my students. When we talked savings, of course, what were the images we used to illustrate that? A piggy bank. I get it. You get it. Didn't work very well for the Muslim students. It was not, you know, many of them were immigrant. They didn't grow up with a piggy bank being the symbol of savings. And of course they wouldn't have. And it was a light bulb moment for me when I figured that one out. So I asked one of them, we've had this argument that these concepts are universal. And I thought, you know, this is a chance to engage my students. And I asked one of them, so I get that piggy bank doesn't work for you. What was the symbol for savings in your country growing up? And he said, oh, we didn't have any money to save. Oh. Okay. So engaging your students, native born or immigrant, in their cultural beliefs, faith beliefs, and the like, important. MCE does some great work, Mr. Chair, and I would certainly urge us to move this bill along. I benefited from their predecessor named organization when I was teaching, and allowed me to incorporate more economics into my middle school instruction, and I have a great respect for the work they're doing, pushing the rock uphill on personal finance education and economics education. So thank you for the hearing for this bill today, Mr. Chair. Thank you all.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Bunn, and Representative Watoon for bringing this bill forward. And it is really needed, and to some of the discussions before around even understanding some of these financial concepts. I want to share the experience through, the experiences of my immigrant refugee, parents, where to Representative Avni's point, when we were living in the refugee camps in Thailand, there was no way of, keeping track or saving any kind of currency that we may have that my family brought with them when they were in Laos coming into Thailand. And now coming to the U.S., where just even the concept of saving money or, having a checking account or saving account was a foreign concept for my parents. And you add on to that, if they don't really have a trust in the financial system over here because of the simple thing, as having somebody that's able to communicate with them in their language when they go to a financial institution, and then to explain to them that foreign concept of what is interest, what is compound interest, how to even open, what is the benefit of being banked that Representative Elkin talked about, of having a checking and savings account. And so I think that this is really needed, and I really appreciate you bringing this forward so that, the rest of, so that all Minnesotans, regardless of where they are from or whatever is their nationality or their background, that they have the opportunity to really learn about the financial institutions that we have here, and to ensure that they understand the consumer protections that are in place to help them as a consumer here in Minnesota. And so I really appreciate the two of you bringing this forward, and Mr. Chair for allowing us to have this opportunity to talk. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Lee. We'll give the last word to Representative Katisa Watoon. Oh, whose screen might be frozen. Representative Katisa Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My internet just dropped. I left the Zoom and came back, so I missed the end of Representative Lee's comment, but I appreciate everybody sharing their stories and for asking some questions and thought-provoking discussion here today. Thank you to my testifiers for being a part of this program and making it more accessible for our educators across the state of Minnesota, who are going to in turn reach so many students and help us continue along this journey so that we can, that our students and the future adult Minnesotans feel better about their personal finance and economics backgrounds. And we'll just see where it takes us. So I would renew my motion that this bill be laid over for possible inclusion, and I would appreciate member support going forward.
Thank you, Vice Chair Katisa Watoon. And with that, we will lay over House File 2146. This concludes our agenda for today. We will be back tomorrow with three bills on the calendar. DFL members, we will be caucusing immediately following the hearing, probably for a very, very brief time, but just wanted to check in real quick. So look for that link in your inbox from the committee administrator. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.